Hi, this is Mandy Griffin.
And I'm Katie Swalwell.
And welcome to Our Dirty Laundry.
Stories of white ladies making a mess of things.
And how we need to clean up our act. Hi, everybody. It's us. You know who we are by now.
Yeah. Maybe.
Unless this is your first time, it's Our Dirty Laundry.
The podcast where you come to hear two white women, friends from childhood, learn about how shitty white women have been and still are. And it's always depressing, but we know you keep coming back because it's super important and we have to learn this and we have to do better.
Right.
And God, I'm mad.
I know. That's what I was going to say. Who's mad today? Hello. I was trying to jump past the intro because I just wanted to be like, listen, we got some shit to talk about. So
I can't even believe that we did not know that this was going to happen, that we would be learning about the history of abortion rights and its connection to eugenics and the way that white women have been involved in that and mucked it up like for decades and decades. I had no idea that as we would be learning about that, this shitstorm would unfold in front of us. I mean, I feel a little bit like it keeps lining up with things anyway, whether we're talking about voting rights and things getting gutted and elections being insane, or whether we're talking about slavery and looking at history through a perspective of critical race theory and then having CRT get crazy. I know our podcast is not causing these things, but it is like eerie.
But the stars have aligned.
It's just all so present. It makes me so mad. I wish this was history. I wish we were learning about history, but we're not. We're learning about current fucking awfulness, and I just can't. Gosh.
So mad. So mad. Like, there are points today where I have been, like, just physically shaking with, like, anger and, like despair, regret, all sorts of things. So, okay. Yeah. So, for anyone who doesn't know, so – I mean, I assume that lots of you do, but this podcast is coming out at the beginning of December, and currently, right now, there is a Supreme Court argument going on, which is Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health, which is looking at the Mississippi law to ban abortions after 15 weeks, which was basically like a fucking setup in the first place. Like,
of course,
the governor like signed this into law knowing that it would get challenged, knowing it would go to the Supreme Court, knowing the court had just been stacked.
It is the culmination of decades of activism that has been, and really the book we're reading, I think, does a good job of pointing to this. It's not about the new right and the ways that Catholics and evangelical Protestants came together and the ways that political operatives, you know, weaponized this issue of abortion, which actually has way more public support. I think that is something that I just can't understand. Like, it's a wedge issue somehow, but it's not, when you look at polls, it isn't as much of a wedge. I just don't, I feel like
it's
my
not,
brain
I mean,
starts
here's the
to
thing.
Fall
like,
apart.
It's not understandable, and yet at the same time, it fits in. And so it makes so much sense with how our system has been set up over time to consolidate power into the hands of a minority that don't actually represent what the fuck the whole population cares about and wants. They represent just what keeps them in power, basically. And that is how the system is set up. So it's mind-blowing, but it's purposeful. It's not an accident. So,
no. And it's very, very strategic and deliberate. And I don't doubt that there are people that, I mean, I can think of people in my own family who are very sincere in their beliefs about this, but this sounds so patronizing to say they're just pawns in a movement, because these are smart people who care about things very deeply. But it is part of this agenda to absolutely undercut the gains in civil rights, in gay rights, in women's rights. Like, these are all connected, and the people who are fighting them, it's all connected for them too, to fight against working class rights, to fight against disability rights. Like, any of those gains in the last 50 years are super deliberately dismantled. I know we're not saying anything new, but I will shout out this article a friend texted us about this morning by Rebecca Traister. You said you've been reading her work for a long time, and I'm not familiar with it. Do you want to talk about
Rebecca Traister? She is a goddess, I think, as I said earlier today. Sure, her writing is amazing. I feel like whenever I've read, so the main book that I read of hers in the past couple of years that I don't know if I've mentioned it on here, but I know I've mentioned it to you in the past that I think we should do something incorporating it on the podcast, but she wrote the book called Good and Mad. And it, I think the subtitle is The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. And it is an amazing book that covers a lot of great shit. But anyway, so she just has a way of writing that it's like every word she says feels important. Like she cuts out all the bullshit. There's no fluff. It's just like straight to the point. So when we got this article from our friend and I saw that it was by her, I was like, oh, yeah, of course it is. Because I started reading it and I was like, I feel like I know this writer. And I looked back at the name and I was like, yeah, that makes sense that she would write this. It's incredible. So we will link to this because everyone should read this article for sure. And it is called The Betrayal of Roe. And it's in New York Magazine, right? NYMag.com?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Yep. Do you want to shout out like your favorite parts? I know you said you highlighted of it, so we shouldn't do a reading of it here. But I did pull some quotes I loved.
I feel like I could do a dramatic reading.
Oh, I was laughing. Remember, this has been a few episodes. I mean, this is like a few months ago, but you were talking about how you were just coming to terms with the fact that you are just purely fueled by rage, like in your life. Yeah, this doesn't help that at all. Yeah, so what were some of your favorite parts of it?
Okay, so, I mean, just from the beginning, when she's talking about how, like, all of this is going down and it's a shit show and, like, there's going to be this huge finger-pointing session where we all try to, like, blame who is, you know, is in charge of all this. And it's like, so feels so good and so easy to like blame everyone from, of course, Donald Trump, who nominated these assholes and put them on the court, to even like people in our party, like Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders and RBG for dying or also not for retiring before she died and could have been replaced by somebody that wasn't Amy Coney Barrett. Anyway.
Well, and you but say, I think you say our party, but I think you are much more party affiliated than I am. Yes, I get super frustrated with like everything. So yes, but I might
clearly, or our people, maybe the liberal side of things, like the progressive side of things,
radical progressive, like anywhere left of center, which sometimes isn't even left anymore.
Right.
But
right.
Yeah, I yeah, like but there is a lot of blame to go around.
Right. And what she says, and what I think is something that we have been focusing on, she says that this impulse itself to point fingers at one individual is short-sighted and self-serving in that it allows us to evade the far more suffocating and incriminating reality that we got to this terrifying place, not just by some wrong turn made recently by one wrong person we don't like, but by decades-long systemic failures. And I think that's what's important about this analysis. And that's what's important about going back and looking at history. And that's why teaching critical race theory in schools is fucking important, because it's not just about individuals. It's not just about just teach your children to be nice and loving and caring and the whole world will be fine. It's not. It's been set into place and it is baked into our system. And it's why we're at where we are now.
Although this is a reminder, this is a picture I took from a tweet earlier today that it's a quote from Assata Shakur. The schools we go to are reflections of the society that created them. Nobody is going to give you the education you need to overthrow them. Nobody is going to teach you your true history. If they know that, that knowledge will help set you free. Which is true. There was to your point earlier about like casting the net really wide to understand all of the tributaries that led to this moment. She says, this is Rachel Tracer. Is that her name? Am I saying that right?
Rebecca.
Thank you, Tracer. Mm-hmm. She said, Democrats have permitted an inaccurate, dishonest right-wing framework, the notion that abortion is some hot-button issue on which the country is sharply divided, when in fact the protection of the right to legal abortion is one of the most popular planks in a Democratic platform, even in red states, to keep them from making political fights about abortion. I'm sure that the argument behind this can be backed up by some pollster or numbers guy or consultant, but the big unspoken reason is that most politicians, the majority of whom remain white men, and many of the rest wealthy white women who themselves will never know inaccessibility of healthcare, find abortion icky and distasteful because they find the bodies and lives and needs of people who need abortions icky and distasteful. Which I just thought fit so well with our eugenics, what we've been learning about it, and that eugenics logic is not a right or left issue. Like, it goes way beyond political parties. Like, it infects so much. And she just goes on to talk about how especially for people whose identities protect them, we can think like, oh, democracy will take care of it. There's this sense that like, oh, it'll all get worked out. Mm-hmm, and it's actually, all of these things are so hard fought and so hard won. She says the voting and reproductive and labor rights now being undone were won over generations, not by those at the top of our systems, but by the most vulnerable bodies working in coalition through their lives on a project that would extend well beyond their deaths over centuries, which is so much of what we've been learning about. The irony is that when those rights and protections were finally codified, they were put under the protection of a party and covered by a press that simply didn't take any of that work, those sacrifices, those stakes seriously. And she goes on to say that she actually gets it, because to take it seriously means daily discomfort. And it would mean listening to and perhaps getting in line behind leaders who come from vulnerable communities and not the elite climbs so insulated from the realities of a terribly unjust system. It would mean making the stories of women and pregnant people central to our understanding of this country and its ability to thrive. And I thought so much of the Combahee River Collective. I thought of all of these, the women of color who were activists in voting rights, or the women of color we've been learning about in reproductive rights, whose point is like, unless we're free, you won't be free. Like, it has to be from, it has to be led from the bottom up, from the most vulnerable, most marginalized up, even knowing that it's like super hard to organize when you are also navigating racism and poverty and all of that, but that it cannot be upper class, upper middle class white people sitting in a room somewhere, even ones, and I will implicate ourselves in this, who have a lot of empathy or are, you know, rhetorically in support of things. That's so different from having lived your experience. Anything else from this article you wanted to shout out?
Yeah, I mean, I think she goes after, there is so much. I could literally read the whole thing. She goes after, I think, the hypocrisy of the system too. She's talking about like the argument that is being made by some of the justices, you know, where they are saying that, you know, this can just go back to the states and people can just vote on it and let democracy really rule, basically, not have the courts rule on it. They're trying to act like they're doing something noble by saying, oh, we shouldn't be the ones deciding this. We should let a fair and equal democracy decide this, which is just fucking bullshit, because she says everyone knew where Gorsuch and Kavanaugh and Barrett stood and what they were put on the court to do. And yet we had to watch some bizarre performance during their confirmation hearings of pretending that they cared enough about precedent to let Roe stand. Supreme Court justices appointed by presidents who won fewer votes than their opponents dared this week to entertain the argument that a functional democratic process would surely protect the abortion rights of those who wanted them should abortion go back to the states. They just sat there with their ill-gotten seats, pretending that democracy was an intact remedy.
Knowing full well there's also attempts to roll back voting rights and voting protections. And like, all it's, oh my God, it's so nefarious and awful and frustrating. I mean,
like you said, if this is overturned, the reason that it would be overturned would then also overturn the precedent for so many other civil rights issues that have been decided in the past couple of decades, because it would have to be overturned on the idea that the court was like egregiously wrong when it decided to protect abortion under the 14th Amendment.
It's states' rights.
And the 14th Amendment, yeah, hello, what have I said about this? Which I know is like states' rights.
Yeah, I know. Well, here, let's – I know we could literally talk about this article all the livelong day, and we will link to it for sure. But I will say, even though she acknowledges, like, millions of people are certainly more deeply fucked than they were before, she does say – and I think this is so true because especially for white women, I think white women who have some kind of, like, empathy or, like, care for these problems, it's so easy to say, like, oh – I just can't even think about it and then just like shut down, you know? She says this does not mean despair or accepting defeat, which would be yet another instance of giving into short-term comfort and ease. It's incumbent on us to not check out, to not give up, as it will be tempting to do on most days, to not evade responsibility by shifting the blame to others, but instead to face the future with the respect owed to our forebears and a crystal clear vision of who is going to be suffering right now and in the coming years. To settle into the work ahead, knowing that the answers won't come in the form of a superhero candidate or a single election cycle, but rather in a rethinking of who's authoritative and who's hysterical, of who should be at the center and who should be at the margins, and staying committed through both wins and losses because people's lives and not just our own grievances are at stake. We must reimagine whose lives and experiences should guide us into a future that must now be different from our recent past. I mean, all the feels
perfect. Yes.
And didn't it make you think of, it made me think of Kara and Susan, who we interviewed a couple of months ago, and their work on health issues. And it made me think of Bree, who we interviewed months ago about organizing and coalition building. So we might even repost those interviews and have people listen to them because they're just so profound. And I think hearing their advice about how to stay connected, how to stay in movements, how to be in movements in ways that actually help move the needle are super important to be reminded of right now in the face of a lot of rollbacks that they're just going to keep coming. I mean, this is
the beginning of the rollback, not the end of it. But I also like, you know, what she said is, and that kind of fits with this reminder of how we need to be engaged, that there's no one politician, no one activist, no single protest or perfect approach to activism that will offer any quick remedy here. Instead, the future is messy and sad and difficult and extremely bleak. These rights were decades in the winning, decades in the undoing, and will be decades in the remaking. And I think that's been so hard to realize over this past year and in reading these histories and in learning more about them, because you sometimes get these surges of hope where you're like, oh, this is going to be the difference. I mean, I think of like the protests after the murder of Ahmaud Arbery and of George
McFlade. George Floyd and Breonna Taylor
and everybody. I think of all of that and how that seemed like, oh, this could be a turning point. And then how it's just so quickly like shifted back into, and nothing really changed and it's all still the same. And that being sort of something that always makes me feel like, fuck, well, we're just screwed here. This is where it's going to stay. But instead it should just be a reminder that this takes like a decades-long approach. It takes continual fighting. It takes not giving up because things will backslide. And it takes recognizing the really insidious and nefarious, like, and calculated process of people who are against this progress.
Oh, and how they're very smart and thoughtful. I mean, in Jennifer Nelson's book, which we're reading, The Women of Color and the Reproductive Rights Movement, I'm still holding out hope we can talk to her. We'll see if we can get in touch with her. But she talks about the new right being so super savvy and organized about this, especially in the 80s and the 90s. I mean, I really think of it's like our lifetimes has been the effort of the new right, and that she says they've understood the connections among issues such as sexuality, work, and family, and understood that the easiest targets for their conservative agenda were poor women. Feminists needed to respond with a class-conscious sexual politics that addressed multiple issues of reproductive freedom. And we'll talk about this group that was trying to do that in a more kind of coalition-building way, but the problems that they ran into. But it really is... just so this comes from one of their pamphlets or a book, I think. It's written by Rosalind Pacheski and Raina Rapp. She says, they say, one reason why the right to life movement has been effective is that its leadership understands the interconnections between abortion and changes in the family, sexuality, and women's work, although its position on these issues is a reactionary one. We can no longer afford to separate abortion from other aspects of reproductive freedom, such as contraception, childcare, prenatal and maternal health care, sexual freedom, particularly for homosexuals and lesbians, and sterilization abuse. An analysis of the interrelated aspects of reproductive freedom arms us to fight effectively against those who are attacking our rights and provides us with the basis for uniting the majority of people in this country around such issues. We have a common interest with all persons of all economic, racial, ethnic, and religious groups who do not want the U.S. government nor any church to decide for them when and under what conditions they may have children, and who wish to expand the existing possibilities of reproductive choice for themselves and all people.
Yeah. And I think this, like this last part of the book that we're at right now, mm-hmm. I was also reminded of it. And Rebecca Tracer, like just to go back to a couple things in her article, because when I was mm-hmm. reading her article, I was like, oh, this is perfect for the end of reading this book. Because
yeah,
I think one of the biggest arguments of Rebecca Nelson's book is that Jennifer Nelson's book mm-hmm. is that economics and reproductive rights are so closely tied together. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Rebecca Tracer brings out in her article that exact same argument that she says it's about a Democratic Party that has, before and since Roe, included lots of politicians who believe in abortion rights and access, but simply do not prioritize it. And who have argued that their party should be more and not less open to those who actively oppose abortion if they're otherwise progressive on economic issues, as if those stances are compatible. Mm-hmm. They are not. And I think that mm-hmm. that is a huge, huge component of this group. That's the focus of the last part of Jennifer Nelson's book is talking about.
Well, yeah. I mean, she, the very ending of this book, I know that's my favorite thing to do is to read the last sentence of someone's book.
Right, that's right.
But please buy these books. They're so great. But Jennifer Nelson says contemporary feminists need to ask themselves, and she's writing this book in the early 2000s. I think it's 2003. Yeah. She mm-hmm. says, are we still fighting for the rights of the women with the least? If we don't fight the battle from the bottom up, we betray the best sentiments of feminism. To give all women access to the freedom to make real reproductive choices for themselves and their families without coercion. And I thought, like, oh my gosh, that's exactly, like, sadly written almost 20 years ago, calling on people who call themselves feminists or people who are involved in these struggles to say, like, get your shit together. What is happening? Like, we got to do this. And, oh, God, this line, you know, it's time for reproductive rights feminists to take stock of the movement and whom it serves could be asked of today.
Yeah.
And it's a moment, like, in this moment when there's such a clear, like, stab wound to these rights, that has to be at the center of the question that we ask ourselves, given who we are and our commitments, like, for whose rights are we fighting? Whose interests are at the center? Who's leading the work? Who's setting the agenda? And Rebecca Tracer is talking about in her article that often the women who are most impacted, who are ringing the alarm bells and who are saying, like, this is super fucked up, get framed as hysterical or radical. Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, just think of, like, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, like, oh, she's naive, she's this. Like, they just get written off so often mm-hmm. by the media, by people who are in established positions of power as, you know, fringe, hysterical people, instead of, like, no, they're who we should be listening to, and they're spot on. You know?
Yeah. 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 And that's the question that Jennifer Nelson asks. And, you know, now she says, now that we better understand how feminists of the 1970s transformed their ideas on reproductive rights, we mm-hmm. need to ask what we can learn from the past in order to mm-hmm. build a better reproductive rights movement for the 21st century. And that could not be, like, a better question for literally today. Like, what are we going to do moving forward? Because it has to happen. It's it's going to happen. In a way, this has, like, catalyzed this happening. And in some ways, That's like, mm-hmm. maybe we need this sort of a setback to have more of a revolution of things. But, mm-hmm. but, you know, I think that's the point of where we need to go now, well, is looking at this history.
I mean, you brought up the international uprising for Black Lives Matter in the wake of George Floyd's murder on top of everything else that's been happening. Like, the question is less to me whether there will be marches in the street. I think Rebecca Traister says the same thing, like, there will be marches. So the question isn't, will there be pushback? It's like, what kind of pushback is it going to be? And will mm-hmm. the people pushing back have learned any lessons from the past?
Right.
So this organization, Carasa, that's in the last chapter, let's spend a little bit of time talking about it. I don't know if I was just so angry that it was hard for me to pay attention when I was reading, but it's one of these things too, where there's tons of acronyms and there's like infighting kinds of things and splinter groups. This happened with suffrage too, where it was a little bit hard to keep track of everything. Right. But my take on Carasa from this book, and now I can't even remember what it stands for.
I've got it right here. Okay. So it's the Committee for Abortion Rights and Against Sterilization Abuse. And it wasn't around that long. I mean, that's something else right. that kind of struck me, but I think it says that they came together and were formed in 1977, right after the Hyde Amendment was upheld by the Supreme Court. But then by like 1983, I think it is, mm-hmm. it says later, they were already disbanded because of multiple reasons, which we'll right. get into in some of this. But
well, let's talk a little bit about the Hyde Amendment.
Yep.
And there was one stat that I just was super hard to read knowing what's likely to happen to Roe v. Wade, but mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. a 1982 report showed that after Roe v. Wade, abortion fatalities dropped by 73%. Just thinking about women who are going to die, you know, mm-hmm. in the wake mm-hmm. of not having abortion protected. Although here's the one thing I want to be careful of as we're talking about this. It's not like, I mean, we don't know what they're going to decide. I think it's like fairly clear which way mm-hmm. that's going to go, but it's not like, oh, we've had super awesome access to abortion and this is going to change that. Like, what this book makes really, really clear is immediately after Roe v. Wade, the Hyde Amendment comes in, which limits federal funding. Like, you can't use Medicaid to pay for abortion. Am I understanding that right?
It's no federal funds can be used to pay for abortions.
Except in the instance of rape or incest or a mother's life being in jeopardy. But if it was rape or incest, you had to report the case to police within 60 days of the event in order mm-hmm. to get permission to have your abortion paid for with these funds. So
right.
I think the book does a great job at showing how for women in poverty and women of color, abortion access has gotten better since Roe v. Wade, but it certainly wasn't protected or guaranteed in the same ways that it was for white and middle-class women.
Right.
And
right.
that maternal health has not been great. Like, I think that's something too, where it's not like, oh, we can't have abortion, so we're going to have a baby and everything's going to be fine, even if we decide to give it up for abortion. Like, maternal health is still super terrifying. And there are really disproportionate rates of death for women giving birth even. So it's, mm-hmm. there, it's mm-hmm. just, again, like, it's a lot more complicated than just like, oh, legal abortion, illegal abortion, a switch right. that flips on and off and everybody feels the impact the same way.
Yeah. They talk about how this group published some statistics on the effects that the upholding Hyde Amendment had on poor mm-hmm. women's access to abortion. So it said in 1977, before the court had decided in favor of Hyde, in Arkansas, Mississippi, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Texas, and then Alabama, Maine, Montana, Nevada, there were performance of 2,366 Medicaid-funded abortions. Mm-hmm. In 1978, the year after the Hyde Amendment was upheld by the Supreme Court, only 31 abortions were certified as reimbursable in Arkansas, Mississippi, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Texas, and no Medicaid-funded abortions were performed in Alabama, Maine, Montana, or Nevada. There had been, in 1 year, a 99% decrease in Medicaid-funded abortions. Mm-hmm. These figures indicated that Hyde had a very real effect on poor women's ability to control right. their fertility.
Meanwhile, federal funds would definitely pay for sterilization.
Exactly.
And yeah, yeah, yeah. that was a much cheaper, much more accessible option. So again, saying choice as if it's an actual fair, like very reasonable, like, oh, it's just your preference, like that for women in poverty, which are disproportionately women of color, that this quote option for sterilization has, or even the legislation or incentives that have said, like, you know, you're not going to keep getting your welfare unless you are sterilized.
Right, just, right. It's plus, so like, how gross is it? And how much, and it points back to Rebecca Traister's point that these politicians that are in control really just find these people who need these services to be deemed like people that are unworthy, that are, they just find them icky because sterilization ends the ability to reproduce permanently of this population. Yeah. So if you're trying to act like you're trying to protect families and protect babies by making abortion harder to access and illegal, yet pushing for sterilization among a very specific population of people, like you're not for families. You're just a fucking racist.
You're for eugenics.
And yeah, you're just a fucking eugenicist is what you are.
This is the last couple of pages is where I feel like Jennifer Nelson like took off the gloves and just like angry typed the rest of her book. she says, with this material before us, we need to ask why the state has an interest in punishing poor pregnant Black women for drug use. Here she's talking about all sorts of policies in the late 90s and early 2000s, like crack. We talked about that group a while back that was like paying women to get sterilized, or the, they were like hospitals were tracking more frequently tracking poor women and women of color when they gave birth doing drug tests, even though drug use is the same, it's the same rate, regardless of demographic, that Black women were arrested at a rate of 10 times that of white women because they were being tested more frequently. So she's talking about all of that. So she says there's two explanations. Oh, that they're punishing poor pregnant Black women for drug use rather than providing them with prenatal care and treatment for drug addiction. There are two explanations for the state's behavior. First, punishing Black women for bearing drug-addicted babies diverts attention from a medical system that overwhelmingly neglects the needs of minority and poor women and their children. And also, the second reason is ideological. We live in a society that has historically denigrated Black women as mothers. She talks about the all the different stereotypes over the years that consistently portray Black women as dangerous to their children and dangerous to society. So she goes on and says, there's a belief in the United States that poor women of color should not reproduce in large numbers because they and their children are considered dangerous and burdensome to society. This belief is the eugenic force behind population control, both domestic and international. It is an attitude that informs the sentiment that only a heterosexual couple who can afford to raise their children independently of the state, white families, should have children. This perspective opens up a host of questions about the relationship between groups of individuals in the state, how these relationships evolved historically, and how they should change. To answer all these questions would be to go beyond what she's trying to do here, but she is says it should not be within the power of the state to decide who should reproduce and who should have their ability to reproduce terminated or constrained. I mean, basically, she's just saying, like, I call bullshit on your policies. Like, there's if you look at them all as a family of policies, which they are, the point is to limit the growth of populations of poor families and families of color. That is the purpose.
And it's hypocrisy to state otherwise because you encourage and act like you're upholding this idea of this nuclear family where there's one breadwinner, and obviously that's the man, and then this woman who stays home and has children, like in this ideal, like, Leave It to Beaver world, you know. And that's what you're saying is the prototype of what we should all be going after. Yet, if those people are going to ask for any state assistance to do that, then it's no longer okay. Like, if you need to be on welfare in order to stay home and watch your kids, then you shouldn't have children. But, or if you need childcare in order to continue having children, you shouldn't have children.
Certain kinds of state aid, like what you just described, like WIC or SNAP, or it's because there, of course, the government is constantly subsidizing wealthy people's decisions. Or think about like the GI Bill. That was like a huge leg up to families, but it was disproportionately supporting white GIs. So it I totally get what you're saying, but I just want to always remember that the state subsidizes everyone in different ways. And so it's like a targeting a particular kind of subsidization because of who it helps. So right. It's like circular.
There's
logic,
an idea, you know? That there's like a right way to do things. It just happens that like that right way is like the way that white people do it most of the time. I mean, I even know a lot of white people, and this is like just, I feel like endemic within, I'm just going to call out the LDS community, the Mormon mm-hmm. community here. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if other religious communities are the same way, but there's such a high utilization of state aid among mm-hmm. very young couples who get married very young and then have a lot of children very young, who just willfully and broadly use state resources, welfare, Medicaid, WIC, all of those things while they are going to school, you know, and then getting into these professional careers. So they're on it for this amount of time and having mm-hmm. the state pay for their young children and their young families. Then they go on to have careers as business people and doctors and mm-hmm. people who make more money, and all of a sudden shun the same politics that allowed them to raise their family because, mm-hmm. and they're fine with it. They would argue against saying that there was a problem with that tooth and nail because they think that's an okay way to mm-hmm. use state aid because they did it that way, but it's not okay for someone else to do it a different way.
And when you talk about like the quote normal or right way to do something, this is where it class and gender and race and sexual identity really intersect. And what I thought was interesting about CROSSA was how its agenda evolved, even in its short time in its existence, that it started as focusing on making sure abortion was federally funded and accessible to poor women, but also an end to sterilization abuse, like that they had learned from the critiques in the earlier generation, mm-hmm. that both of those issues were part of the same problem and might impact different women differently, but were both really worth fighting for. And then they expanded their agenda to include occupational health and safety, mm-hmm. which let's put a pin in that because holy shit, I knew none of that information.
No, I didn't either.
And that was crazy. Like so disturbing. And then the state subsidized childcare, which I, as a mom of two young children who can afford private daycare and is still like blown away by how complex and difficult it is, this is like my kind of number one issue right now that I am so outraged about, that we don't have a better system for childcare in a country that supposedly, like, especially this idea of like a minority party ruling on the logic of some quote normal family or what are like family first or whatever, knowing how many kids are fucked over by not having better childcare options, mm-hmm. more accessible, like higher quality childcare options, is one of those moments where you have to call bullshit on this agenda because it's just like tragic and infuriating. And then the last issue, and this is what made me think of this like normal, quote, normal family, is that they were, they expanded to include or to be more clear about their position on lesbian rights, especially mm-hmm. and LGBTQ rights. So this is again, late 70s, early 80s. And so part of what they started arguing for, and it, from what I could tell from this chapter, that it, a lot of this, it like started off as socialist feminists who started the group, and they were coming from like very much foregrounding economic relationships to reproductive rights and coming from like civil rights movement and anti-war movement backgrounds. And then the newer women that joined the coalition were, most of them were, I shouldn't say most, but many of the women that were really vocal or in leadership roles were lesbians who also were wanting to foreground lesbian rights in all of this. And whether it was thinking about sexual freedom and the freedom to have sex with whoever you want to have sex with without punishment or without discrimination. And then also to think about women who had children and came out as lesbians wanting to be able to have their maternal right protected.
Recognized.
Or women who were in a couple to be able to even have children or adopt children. I'm just thinking about a good friend of mine who is married to a woman and they have children, and the what they went through to have to like the expense, the legal expense, and then just the logistics of having to formally adopt each other's children to be mm-hmm. a family in ways that I never had to even think about. Yeah. I just went to a hospital, had a kid, my husband signed the paper like he's the dad, the end, you know?
Yeah.
So I was really intrigued by that shift, and also the ways that the group kind of splintered apart after, and trying to think about, this tension of coalition building, of wanting to honor different experiences and a multifaceted agenda, but how hard that is to do. And
yep.
It just sounded like it sort of collapsed under its own weight of trying to be all things to all people in the group. I don't know. Was that your sense of what happened?
Yeah. And that's where I struggle with how can we do it better this time around? Mm-hmm. How can we still represent all of these different interests and not fall apart? Because we have to. Because when things fall apart, then we end up where we're at now, instead of where we could have been had this group been able to stay together and been able to keep going where they were headed, at least when they started out. There's just a bunch of different things that I had highlighted and wanting to bring up. I don't know that it's directly connected, but a couple of the things that really stood out to me was about like the economics being at the center of what they were focusing on. Mm-hmm, and you brought this up about their socialist roots probably. And it talks about how this group, when they formed, pointed out that a woman's income and economic assets determined her ability to control her reproduction in a capitalist society. The abortion rights feminists had neglected to put economics at the center of their politics of quote-unquote choice, which left poor women vulnerable to conservative attacks on reproductive freedom, which I think is one of the reasons that we're here now, is that we didn't continue to focus on that. And they talk about how, you know, capitalism puts certain limits on how healthy anyone can be. And they give a couple of examples, like even back when we're talking about the Puerto Ricans and the Young Lords in the chapter before, they're saying like the vast majority of Puerto Rican women sterilized in New York, based on one study, 80% of them said they did so for socioeconomic reasons. If they had been given the economic means to have more children, many of them might have made that choice instead of choosing to be sterilized. So I think this focus on like the way that economics and capitalism plays together to really like put a damper on any of the progress that we can make in this is important to address from the beginning. They said in one part, Jennifer Nelson also says reproductive rights politics weren't important in this one study. They're talking about how poor women weren't as involved in the reproductive rights politics. And they said they weren't important because being poor exhausted all of their energies. Until their poverty ended, poor and minority women would have little interest in any organization that did not directly and concretely address and relieve their economic problems. And I think that's another reason they said that Carasa ended up falling apart too. Like so many of these women did have like families and careers and like children they were trying to take care of. And in the end, like they just didn't have the time and the energy to put forth into it to keep it together.
It just seems like the deck is so stacked against who needs to be the agents of change. You know, like the thought of people in power have all this structural advantage. That's the point. Like that's what we're trying to fight against anyway, but it's not just the point. It also means the deck is just so permanently stacked against folks. And I know what there are really wonderful models of mutual aid societies and, you know, different ways of being in activism or being in coalition with each other. I'm trying to learn more about the mutual aid societies in my community. I'm sure most communities have some. So I know there are models that take all of this into account. But at the end of the day, it just is really fucking hard. You know, like if you're poor and you're working and you've got kids and you've got a pandemic going on and you've like, how, like on one level, like, of course you have to be engaged in grassroots activism because what other choice do you have? But on the other level, like, oh my God, you just need to sleep and like get food to your kids, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it is, so it's interesting. And my take on the Carasa leadership was that they mostly were middle-class white women, some lesbian, some straight, but most of them, not all of them. But it was interesting to read about their efforts at coalition building, like what didn't go well and what did go well. Like at one point realizing like, oh, we've tried really hard to have this agenda that's super inclusive. But at one point, Jennifer Nelson says that they sort of realized that they'd created a political agenda without consulting the women they claimed they wanted to help. Like they were doing it like in a kind of intellectual way versus a true collaboration or a true coalition. The one collaboration that sounded actually really successful, or at least like more in line with what they wanted to do, had to do with the Medgar Evers College at CUNY. Do you remember this example?
Yes. What page is it on? Because I know
this is 167 for everyone following along at home. Please buy this book, Women of Color and the Reproductive Rights Movement by Jennifer Nelson. But she talks about and CRASA was mostly New York City, right?
Yeah.
That they were pretty New York focused. That 73% of the students at Medgar Evers College were Black women, and many of them were low-income women who also had children. And so when they were talking about what would make life easier and better for them, the number one issue was childcare. Mm-hmm. And even for CUNY faculty and staff, CUNY, I don't know how to.
I don't know how people say that either.
CUNY sounds like vaguely not great.
Yeah.
I don't know. So they said that over 20% of the students have young children, yet the Board of Trustees had no funding for childcare in their budget of 1982. And even some buildings were deemed off limits to children, like you weren't allowed to bring children into certain buildings. So, the group said the demand for daycare facilities is not a privilege. For a woman to stay home and take care of children and be denied the right to an education is a reflection of the backwardness and sexism of society. And just as a reminder, the U.S. is just stands alone as a hyper-industrialized, super wealthy nation that has no like substantial maternity benefits, healthcare, or childcare. Yep. Just as a reminder for people who think this is just how it has to be, it is not this way in other places. So it sounds like they came together. Their other demands were a women's center, an end to sexual harassment, and a Black woman being hired as the college's president. Mm-hmm. So they came together to talk about how they, you know, like what the plan was and how they could work together to do this. And it sounded like the CRASA members' role was to really listen to the critiques of how they had done things before and to really listen to the needs of the Medgar Evers groups and then be in solidarity with them, like accountability, not even accountability partners, but like what do you need us to do kind of position.
Right. And it's, I think she said like kind of one of the things they learned about it is that the activists needed to continue to fight against reproductive problems that affected poor and minority women, while at the same time, they allowed them to define their own battles. Many in CRASA found this a difficult balance to maintain. So that's just an example of like going into a group and being like, here we are to help with this problem, and people being like, oh, that's not the problem we need help with. And then being willing to like listen and
do that other problem. Well, the ones that hit really close to home for me were thinking about how CRASA's coalition building attempts were often more rhetorical than concrete. That hit very close to home. And then this is a quote on page 170, that there was a conference that was trying to gather people together, like a reproductive rights conference. Mm-hmm. And that basically at the conference, it came out that there were critiques of the white women who were saying they wanted to deal with racism, but were not willing to relinquish their power. Mm-hmm. Jennifer Nelson goes on to say, many CRASA feminists struggled to meet these demands, but found that creating an all-inclusive feminism would take more than a rhetorical commitment to addressing poor women's needs. They would have to make such issues as welfare rights, state subsidies for public housing, and Medicaid coverage for all healthcare needs, including abortion, top priorities. And that, to your point, like they would have to do things differently or fight for different things than maybe what they would have had on their agenda. Mm-hmm. And I think this is also when the splintering happened with lesbian members saying like, we also need to think about lesbian rights and that has to be front and center. And there were lots of actions happening with that. And it just sounds like one of the challenges is having, well, the first challenge is getting like white upper middle class women to listen and to follow directions. And then another is to have like a multi-pronged, multifaceted agenda that everybody feels represented in and, you know, like bought into it in some way. And then, of course, you add on to the fact that these are all like working mothers, and that's hard always. Yeah. And then the last part.
Oh, okay. So
maybe I was just going to say, like, the other big thing that happened was in the 80s is like a super intensified right-wing terror campaign that was like straight up murdering abortion doctors, clinics. Harassing women getting abortions or people getting abortions. And that they felt like, oh shit, we need to just spend our time like accompanying people to clinics so they don't get murdered or they don't get harassed. And she says on page 171, efforts at political all-inclusiveness, including attempts at building a movement that prioritized poor women's interests, fell away as reproductive rights feminists organized into clinic defense groups. Suddenly, they needed to mobilize forces to simply help patients enter abortion clinics safely. Again, just the deck being so stacked against the kind of community building and coalition and activism. It's just so hard. I don't want to sound like super depressed, but
no, but there's so many things. She says a little bit earlier in the chapter that one of the reasons the Right to Life movement has been effective is that its leadership understands the interconnections between abortion and changes in the family, sexuality, and women's work. Mm-hmm. Although its position on these issues is a reactionary one. We can no longer afford to separate abortion from other aspects of reproductive freedom, such as contraception, childcare, prenatal and maternal care, sexual freedom, particularly for homosexuals and lesbians, and sterilization abuse. An analysis of the interrelated aspects of reproductive freedom arms us to fight effectively against those who are attacking our rights and provides us with a basis for uniting the majority of the people in this country around such interests. We have a common interest with all persons of all economic, racial, ethnic, and religious groups who do not want the U.S. government or any church to decide for them when and under what conditions they may have children, and who wish to expand the existing possibilities of reproductive choice for themselves and all people. And I think that is one of the main points, is that the Right to Life and the very conservative agenda and that whole movement has understood these things and has played it off very well. And when we do pick just one issue to focus on, like just abortion rights or just sterilization abuse or just, you know, police reform or just this, like, we're not understanding the interrelatedness. And then we can't pull in the number of people that we have to pull in order for this to work, because we're splintered off into all of these different groups.
We do need to talk to Bree again, because I just like want her organizing wisdom in our ears, you know, thinking through this. I really want to talk about this, the occupational health and safety part of it, but I'm wondering if that isn't a really good mini-sode topic, because
It was so interesting.
Fuck?
Yeah. And it's
probably, and then I know we need to reach out to Kate Schatz again for our like not shitty white woman moment in every one of our series. And there's a woman I really want to learn more about was an attorney for Karasa, Rhonda Copeland. I'm not sure if I'm saying her name right. But I you know how I like to rabbit hole all of the people that anyone ever mentions. And so I was starting to learn about her, and I was really, really blown away by her history. So that's someone I want to talk about more. But just as like a shout out for some of the women who were involved in Karasa, the first co-chair for a couple of years was a woman, Meredith Tax, who I think is still living. It was a little bit hard to find out about all of these women. And of course, they have just like incredible careers and activism that they were involved in. But Meredith Tax was one she mentioned. Helen Rodriguez Triez was a Puerto Rican woman who was involved with Karasa, and just an absolutely incredible doctor who has this like unbelievable career behind her as well. There were other women, Rosalind Pacheski, Karen Stamm, Barbara Zelek, other folks that got mentioned. And I learned a little bit about them. So if we ever want to follow up, we can talk about them as well. Maxine Wolf was another. I don't know if these names will be familiar to any listeners or encourage you to look into their histories, but really, really fascinating. Like Maxine Wolf is an example of a woman who was really pushing for attention to lesbian issues, and then went on to do just unbelievable organizing in the gay movement, feminist movement, AIDS movement. The connection also with activism around AIDS awareness, I think, is super fascinating. It just thinking about connections to public health and human rights, like what we have access to as humans and what kind of community we want, society we want, just all of it is fascinating. So
yeah,
those are some names to follow up on.
Yeah. A lot more details and rabbit holes to go down for sure. I did have one other part highlighted that I think is maybe like a good way to wrap up this discussion of the book in general, but they talked about, an event that Karasa held in 1979 that was the Abortion Rights Action Week, where they wanted to have just kind of a place for women to come together, because they said Karasa members believed that the majority of women in New York State and elsewhere in the United States wanted access to abortion but didn't have a form to show their support, which is what we're saying. Like, the statistics still show that abortion is not as a divisive issue as it is played out to be, that most Americans believe that there should be at least some level of legal abortion and don't want Roe to be overturned. So they had this Abortion Rights Action Week so that they could take more of an offensive position in battling with the right to life movement over access to legal abortion. And so they came up with a statement and the petition that they had people sign, and then they delivered it to Congress. And the conclusion of the petition is something that I had highlighted. It says, and this is on page 153, she said, "We believe that women's reproductive freedom and the right to choose when and if to have children can only be secured when our society provides support for women, whatever choice they make." And I think that incorporates all of the different facets of what they were trying to do. Like, if you decide to have children, if you don't decide to have children, if you decide to work, if you decide not to, like, if you have to work and can't decide not to, like, we have to be, if we are really going to be a society that says that we care about all individuals and about families and about children, then we have to support them in all circumstances, not just the ones that we take some moral stance in believing are okay.
You know, the other thing I wrote, I highlighted that part as well, and was just thinking about like the Human Life Amendment that got proposed that would have made it, you would have been up on manslaughter charges for abortion. It failed, but it's like the same logic as around today. Or making contraception, like birth control pills or IUDs, illegal, because the like thinking about when does life start even, or like thinking of the eggs as like potential fetuses, you know, just like where does it end? And I, my husband and I struggled with infertility. It's so incredibly painful. One of the things I was thinking about are for any people who have miscarriages, to understand, like, in the context of a society that has abortion as like a criminal illegal thing, for for people who lose pregnancies naturally, which of course happens so much more frequently than we talk about, you know, it's something that really only you find out, like, kind of the same way with abortion. Like, you have to be friends with someone and talk to them and get to know them for a long time, and then maybe they will tell you that happened. But that the last thing someone needs in that scenario is to somehow prove that it was like a miscarriage to avoid being brought up on felony charges. Like, I just know, having been in the dark depths of struggles with all of that, just how horrible. I mean, all of this is just so off. Like, there's just so many dimensions of it that put people in really horrible, heartbreaking, awful situations. And just for anyone who's out there listening and struggling with that, or who's, you know, making decisions right now about what to do, or is in positions where they have been in, made, you know, had to have difficult choices or whatever it is. And we just know that for so many people listening, that these are not like esoteric conversations. These are just incredibly personal stories that a lot of this will trigger deeply, deeply personal, tragic, hard sorts of things, or people who made the decision to have an abortion and are incredibly grateful. Like, I don't know if you saw Cecily Strong's SNL skit. Mm-hmm. Did I send this to you? Where she talked about having had an abortion. It's well worth watching for people who are interested, but how that decision was what enabled her to live the life that she wanted to live for herself. And I just want to acknowledge that we've been talking about it as like a political, policy, legal kind of concept, organizational activist kind of concept, but just appreciating anybody listening to this, that we know all of this is also just
very, very the personal.
Most personal
yeah.
thing you can go through. So our heart goes out to you. We hope you have support and love and peace in your decision making. And we hope you feel like you've had decisions to make. I mean, it's just all so hard. So
yeah.
Love to everybody.
Yes. All right. Well, we will come back again. We probably won't be any less angry, but that's okay. Stay angry. That's going to be my sign off to everyone now. Mm-hmm. Stay angry because anger is a catalyst for change and progress. And we can sit. I'm going to sit in my despair about this for a little while, but also use it to keep doing something about it. You know,
thanks for listening. We appreciate it. Have a good day.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.